listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A surprise announcement on Tuesday had Washington and the international diplomatic community all a buzz.
Nikki Haley, ambassador to the United Nations, has been very special to me. She's done an incredible job. Nikki will be leaving.
I'm not leaving until the end of the year. My goal is that we make sure that everything is in good place and for the next ambassador to come in. But I don't have anything set on where I'm going to go. And I will say this for all of you that are going to ask about 2020. No, I'm not running for 2020. I can promise you what I'll be doing is campaigning for this one. So I look forward to supporting the president in the next election.
That's so good. Thank you.
This was Stepan Dujarric, the spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, reacting.
The Secretary General wishes to express his deep appreciation for the excellent cooperation and support that Ambassador Haley has always demonstrated. They had a very productive and strong working relationship during her tenure as United States Permanent Representative. They worked hard to promote constructive ties between the United Nations and the United States, showing the value of the United Nations. The Secretary General looks forward to continuing to work with Ambassador Haley until the end of her tenure, and of course with her replacement.
Russia's ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, expressed surprise when he spoke with the press about Haley's resignation.
As it is clear from what we heard today, that was her decision and we have to respect it. I regret that she's leaving because we had good working and personal relations, despite all the differences that we were and are having. But I rejoice at the fact that she's not leaving yet. It was not a resignation per se, it was an announcement of a resignation. So we'll still have ample time to be here together before the end of her stay with the U.S. mission here. Shock maybe is not the proper word, but that was a surprise, and not a very pleasant one for me personally. She's a charismatic personality. She was a friend to all of us. And as I said many times over, that beyond the doors of the Security Council room, we as a group were very friendly. I'm planning to enjoy as much time with her before she leaves.
Haley served as the 29th U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Again, she'll leave her post at the end of the year. President Trump has said a successor will be named in the coming weeks. Washington journalist Nathan King filed this report for China's global television network, CGTN.
Just 2 weeks after the U.S. president and his U.N. ambassador were sent to stage at the United Nations General Assembly, Nikki Haley is resigning. Speculation is rife about why, and the timing caught many officials by surprise. But in front of the cameras, at least, their parting was amicable.
Look at what has happened in 2 years with the United States on foreign policy. Now, the United States is respected. Countries may not like what we do, but they respect what we do.
The America First policy was never popular at the United Nations, but Haley did score some successes. Sanctions resolutions against the DPRK's nuclear and missile program forged with China and Russia, a rare moment of consensus in the Security Council. But she was also a hawk on Iran, fully backing Washington's withdrawal from the nuclear deal and pushing for a tougher line against Tehran throughout the UN.
The United States has evidence of consistent and wide-ranging Russian violations.
She did differ from the president when it came to Russia, sometimes getting ahead of him when it came to strong words against Moscow. But in Tuesday's Oval Office meeting, nothing but praise for her boss.
Nikki Haley, ambassador to the United Nations, has been very special to me. She's done an incredible job. She's a fantastic person, very importantly, but she also is somebody that gets it. She has been at the United Nations from the beginning with us, right from the beginning, and worked with us on the campaign.
A rising star in the Republican Party, there's been speculation she may challenge Trump for the party's presidential nomination in 2020. Sitting next to Trump, however, she ruled that out.
No, I'm not running for 2020. I can promise you what I'll be doing is campaigning for this one.
Her resignation comes, however, as U.S. popularity in the world plunged to generational lows and as the U.S. pulls out of or away from many U.N. institutions like the Human Rights Council, the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court, and has stopped funding some U.N. agencies, further eroding international support. So speculation already rife about who will replace Nikki Haley. Lots of names out there, but whoever is selected and then has to be confirmed by the US Senate will have to defend the America First policy in front of the world. Nathan King, CGTN, at the White House.
Regardless of Nikki Haley's employment status, US foreign policy continued to plod along. This was Heather Nauert, spokesperson for the State Department, at a press conference in Washington Tuesday.
Okay, a couple announcements to start before we're able to take a few questions today. First, I'd like to address the earthquake and tsunami in central Sulawesi in Indonesia. And I'd like to say that the United States is coordinating closely with the government of Indonesia to respond to the earthquake and tsunami that struck there. Since I spoke to you last week, the United States, through USAID, is now providing a total of $3.7 million in assistance through our partners to deliver essential relief items, including shelter kits, blankets, hygiene kits, solar-powered lamps, and other life-saving aid. USAID is also airlifting heavy-duty plastic sheeting to Indonesia to provide for emergency shelter needs of up to 110,500 people. USAID has deployed a team of disaster experts to coordinate our humanitarian response efforts and is supporting a U.S. Forest Service emergency operations expert who's on the ground providing technical support to the government of Indonesia's disaster response. The Department of Defense has provided three C-130s and has already transported nearly 63 metric tons of disaster relief supplies into the affected areas. The U.S. government has also provided advanced technologies to help the government of Indonesia map the disaster area. In addition, American companies have also mobilized to respond with financial donations, heavy equipment, transportation, and other humanitarian supplies. The U.S. citizens we were aware of in the affected areas have been evacuated. We have no reports of U.S. citizens who've been injured or killed by the earthquake or the tsunami, and we urge any additional U.S. citizens in the affected areas to contact their loved ones directly and update them on their social media status. If you're in the affected area and need emergency services, please contact the local authorities. Next, I want to address something that the secretary raised last week, because nothing has changed. There are still 65 State Department nominees sitting in the United States Senate. That's over a quarter of all the senior level confirmable positions that the United States Department of State is tasked with using to achieve its diplomatic outcomes. There is bipartisan agreement that a fully staffed State Department is critical to American national security. The State Department has been criticized for having gaps in leadership positions, but now we've done our part to fix that. Now the Senate needs to do its part. As the secretary has said, these candidates are quality candidates. They're not sitting on the Senate floor because of objections with respect to their quality, their professionalism, or their excellence and ability to deliver American foreign policy. The secretary had addressed this last week, and he said, "We have members of the Senate for whom partisanship has now driven delay and obstruction of getting America's diplomatic corps into every corner of the world. What Senator Menendez and other members of the Senate are doing to hold back American diplomacy rests squarely on their shoulders." And with that, I'd be happy to take your questions. And you want to go ahead?
I'd like to ask about Jamal Khashoggi. Mm-hmm. Have you received any response from Saudi Arabia since Secretary Pompeo registered concerns regarding his disappearance?
Sure. Let's start out first. I'd like to say I imagine that most, if not all of you, saw the statement that we put out last night. You probably also heard the president's comments about it yesterday, and also the vice president's tweet that he put out yesterday. From the secretary on down, we have been engaged in this matter. This is something that we've been following. I understand that the president intends to speak with the Saudis, so I'm not going to get ahead of that conversation that the president may be having. In the secretary's statement, he said that we've seen conflicting reports about his status. We're not going to make any judgments about what had happened to him. The United States is certainly concerned about his whereabouts. Senior officials at the State Department have spoken with Saudi officials through diplomatic channels about the matter. We call on the government of Saudi Arabia to conduct a thorough and transparent investigation.
It was nearly a week between his first reports of his disappearance mm-hmm. and that statement from Secretary Pompeo. Why was there such a delay between those two events?
So are you assuming that taking time to put out a statement means that the State Department has not been doing anything? Is that your assumption?
What was the State Department doing before
the State Department was engaged at the highest levels and also at the working level in having conversations with Saudi government officials, and I'll leave it at that.
And then, so what was the reason behind that delay in the statement coming out?
I wouldn't call it a delay. The United States government, as we handle situations in other countries as well, sometimes we decide to conduct our conversations and to conduct our diplomacy more privately than publicly, because we feel that that could have the best outcome. And I'll leave it at that. Okay. Hi, Leslie. Go ahead.
Hi. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You must be exhausted.
Kylie's here. I'm here. So we're doing okay for so far.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Has the U.S. seen any evidence that Jamal might be alive?
We don't know. What has happened to him. We don't have any information on that. That's why I want to say we don't want to make any judgments about what happened, and we call for a thorough and transparent investigation.
You called for a thorough and transparent inspection from the investigation from the Saudis, but what about the Turks? Have you asked them for their evidence?
I don't have any information on that. I think that would be in the FBI's lane and local investigators' lane.
You said there's a diplomatic channels. You've mm-hmm. spoken to the Saudis, but what about the Turks?
I don't have any information on that. I would imagine that through the course of our conversations with the Turkish government, we have many conversations with the Turkish government, that this has certainly come up.
Friday, I saw in the public schedule that Mr. Hale had a meeting with the Turkish ambassador mm-hmm. here at the State Department.
I was out on Friday, so I don't recall what was on his public schedule. I'd have to just double check on that.
Okay.
So I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm just not aware of it. If it did, I was out on Friday.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
But since this happened on Turkish soil, wouldn't mm-hmm. speaking to the Turks and being part of their investigation be absolutely key?
I did not say that we have not spoken with the Turkish government. I just don't have any information on it at this moment. Okay. If I have anything additional for you, I'll let you know. Hey, Carol.
Hi, can I ask a follow-up on Jamal Khashoggi? So the UK Foreign Secretary has said that if the reports are correct, quote, we will treat the incident seriously. Mm-hmm. I want to ask, why has not Secretary Pompeo said that if the reports are true and the Saudis, our allies, turn out to be cold-blooded killers, that there will be repercussions?
I think that would be entirely a hypothetical question. And so if the Brits decide they want to comment that way, they're more than welcome to do so. But we're going to wait until the facts come out and we call again for a thorough and transparent investigation.
Will there be repercussions?
Carol, I'm not going to get ahead or assume that anything happened. We're calling for a thorough and transparent investigation. And again, let me say this one more time. I'll leave it at that. I don't have anything more for you on this today.
Can you just confirm if it was Pompeo?
Secretary planned to speak himself with his counterpart in Saudi Arabia, and did he raise this question when he spoke with the Crown Prince last week?
I can confirm that the Secretary has had phone conversations, but I don't have any of the details, and some of those would just be private diplomatic conversations, which I will not be able to read out. Last time I'll say this, I don't have anything more for you on this today. If and when I have more, I will bring it to you, okay? Go right ahead.
On the Palestinian issue.
Yes.
Two quick. One more follow-up on Khashoggi,
sir, I don't have anything.
It's in relation to what you just said.
I don't have anything more for you on that. When I do, I would be happy to give it to you.
And you decide if you don't.
Okay, I've not met you before, but go right ahead. Welcome to the State Department. And tell me your publication.
Fadi Mansour with Al Jazeera. I've been covering this place for 10 years now. Thank you very much.
Pardon me?
I've been covering this place for 10 years. I don't come every day.
Okay. Well, it's nice to meet you. You're welcome anytime.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to ask questions.
And this will be the last question on this. Go ahead.
Thank you. So the fact that you called on the Saudis to carry an investigation, is the State Department assuming that Saudi Arabia is responsible for the whereabouts of Khashoggi?
We're not assuming anything, only because it was their consulate. We're asking them to conduct an investigation.
Thank you.
Saeed, go right ahead.
Very quickly, U.S. envoy, Mr. Greenblatt, said that the Trump plan, the deal of the century, is heavily focused on Israeli security. Does that mean that you guys are giving up on the two-state solution, or you don't see any contradictions between?
This is something that we have talked about for a very, very long time. We support that if both parties can agree to it.
Right.
That hasn't changed.
This was only yesterday. I mean, he went out of his way to say that it is focused on Israeli security. What does that mean to you?
I'm not going to parse his words. I just refer you back to his comments. But our position has not changed, as the president has laid out, as he did not too long ago at the UN General Assembly, that we support a two-state solution if both sides can agree to that.
And one quick question on a young American student who has been detained in Israel for the past 5 days because she supports BDS. Can you share with us, have you done anything? Has she contacted the American embassy, or are you in touch with her?
We are aware of her case. Our embassy is providing consular access, as we would to all American citizens. We value freedom of expression. You and I have talked about this many times. Also in cases where people don't agree with local policies or even the United States policies. Ultimately, it is up to the government of Israel to decide who it wants to let into the country. I don't have anything more for you on that.
This young woman, Lara Al-Qassem, she has a visa. She was accepted at the Hebrew University. She was going there to study and so on. All the stuff that she should have done was already done. Are you not concerned about that?
Saeed, it's ultimately up to the government of Israel, or any country for that matter, to decide which individuals, which Americans it wants to let in. Okay?
The issue here is not that she wasn't allowed in, it's that she's being detained.
Excuse me, or being detained. I don't have any information beyond that, okay? Lori, go right ahead.
Naja Murad, the Yazidi woman who was captured by ISIS and held captive, just won the Nobel Peace Prize, probably everyone knows, and she spoke yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And she did note one positive point, the start of demining in Yazidi areas, which I assume is related to Secretary Pompeo's announcement in July at the Religious Freedom Conference of extra money for demining in the northern Iraq, the religious minority area. So they're very happy with that. But overall, it was a grim picture, and among her complaints was no justice for Yazidis. And you and others, including the UN, have recognized ISIS assault on the Yazidis as genocide, but the Iraqi government hasn't. Are you prepared to put any pressure on them to do so?
I'm not familiar with her remarks. Of course, I'm familiar with who she is. She was one of the guests at our religious freedom ministerial that was held over the summer. We were so proud to have hosted her here. My understanding is that the vice president is meeting with her. I believe it's today. The secretary and I had a brief exchange about her becoming one of the co-winners of the Nobel Peace Prize, and we're really proud of her. She's a very heroic woman who's done so much to advance the cause of not just religious freedom, but also freedom for women, especially freedom from sexual crimes. I don't have her comments. I don't have those remarks, so I'm just not going to comment on it beyond that.
How about her call for an international criminal trial for those members of ISIS who have committed these crimes against Yazidis?
I'm afraid I just don't have anything for you on that today. Okay? Okay. Hi. And how are you?
Thank you. Welcome.
From Korea.
Thank you.
Okay. On North Korea, this trip has Kim Jong-un submitted a list of nuclear facilities, or you got anything from him for evidence of a nuclear list?
We sure did. We made a lot of progress. As you know, we just got back from last night from four countries, and I think it was 3 days. So it was a very busy time. The Secretary and Chairman Kim discussed the four pillars of the Singapore summit. That was something that was important for them to do. They spent considerable time together. The Secretary and the President, of course, have referenced that since. The Secretary just over at the White House speaking about this. Among the things they also discussed was an upcoming second summit that would be attended by our President and also Chairman Kim, and we look forward to working on all of the details of that. They also agreed to instruct their respective working level groups, led by Steve Biegun, our special representative, and also his counterpart, who was named in North Korea, to start intensifying discussions on some of those four pillars that were laid out in the Singapore summit. As you know, Chairman Kim had invited inspectors to visit the Pyongyang nuclear test site to confirm that it has been irreversibly dismantled. We were pleased with that. And President Trump looks forward to continuing to build upon the trust that was first established at the Singapore summit. So we view it as making a lot of progress. We're pleased with that.
But North Korea has already destroyed the Punggye-ri nuclear site and the Dongchang-ri missile site.
I think we can say this. We can affirmatively say that they invited a group of journalists out to watch something take place. Inspectors have not been there yet. So inviting inspectors to join, to take a look, and do their work is entirely different from what we've seen already.
Is that helpful for denuclearization?
I'm sorry?
Is this helpful for the denuclearization, for what you need?
That would be a positive step forward, and Chairman Kim agreed to that, to have inspectors at that site. Okay, go ahead. Let's just, hold on, I'll come back to you. Hi.
So you've made progress on a Trump-Kim summit. Do you have any idea of, like, the timing on that? Like, will it be before the end of the year or sometime afterwards?
Well, as the president has said, and I'm not going to get ahead of the president, of course, but the president has said he looks forward to seeing Chairman Kim soon. As you all remember, when we were planning for the Singapore summit, that takes time. There are a lot of details that are involved in pulling together a summit of that magnitude. We need to find a place that both countries can get to. We have to compare schedules, Chairman Kim's schedule, the president's schedule, the secretary's schedule, probably National Security Advisor Bolton's schedule, a lot of schedules. We also have to identify a place that has the infrastructure that is needed to accommodate 5,000 journalists. I believe there are 5,000 that were accredited last time. So there are a lot of things that that come into play here, and so we are hard at work at that. I know Steve Biegun looks forward to having follow-on conversations with his counterpart about some of those details that go into the summit, and as soon as we have something for you, we'll let you know.
Okay? So did you say that the what you're waiting for to announce even a time or a location for that, is it all just logistical then?
Well, Michelle, as I just said, and I'll repeat it again, a lot goes into this. We start with comparing schedules.
You don't have to repeat it.
Okay.
I'm trying to save you some time. So are you saying that it's all logistical before you announce a date and time, or are you waiting for North Korea to do something?
We are looking forward to having our second summit.
The president is looking forward to doing that. The timing of that will ultimately be announced by the White House. It'll be a White House-led meeting. And when we're ready to announce that, we will.
But the question is, yeah, since you listed all the logistics involved, mm-hmm, are you simply waiting for logistics, or are you waiting for North Korea to do something related to denuclearization?
We have not said anything about waiting for North Korea to do anything more. Okay. In order to have that summit.
And when you say a lot of progress, since Pyongyang-ri is, by many accounts, an aging facility that's already been destroyed, by allowing inspectors to come there and see this, that which is not necessarily key to North Korea's current and future nuclear program, why would you characterize that as a lot of progress?
Michelle, I think that's a very good step. I'll go back and say it one more time. What you have seen were a bunch of journalists brought out to that site, and you saw some sort of an explosion. Sending in inspectors to take a look around is an entirely different step, and a step in the right direction, and we think that that's progress, along with the other things that were addressed in the meeting. Nick, go ahead.
Just as a follow-up to that, I think one of the big questions is what exactly the administration, Secretary Pompeo, President Trump, actually want to achieve from this summit. What's the headline?
I'm not going to get ahead of the president. The secretary firmly believes, and I know that this is much to your dismay, to reporters' dismay, that our negotiations are best handled in public. So I'm not going to negotiate it here with all of you from the podium, and I'll let our experts do the negotiating and do their work and not get ahead of that. Okay? Hi.
The first summit was about general commitments, complete denuclearization by Chairman Kim. Do you expect from the next summit to achieve a broader agreement with
of what is being discussed at that summit? Okay,
not
my job
is
not is not my job is not to lay out what our policy will be.
But because we see your goal, we don't see your method.
So that's a fair point. You see our goal, but you don't see our method.
That is something that we will discuss.
We will discuss that with the North Koreans and not the broader public, not the media, because we believe that negotiations, some of these complicated negotiations, are best handled between our country and theirs. And our objective is to get to the fully final verified denuclearization of North Korea. We are working hard toward that goal. We think we've made progress, and we'll continue working toward that goal. Go ahead.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So Secretary Pompeo did not meet with the Chinese President Xi Jinping on Monday. Could you please shed some light on what happened and what was the reason given provided by Chinese government? Because it's an understanding that arrangements were being made for this meeting to happen.
So we never announced any specific meetings ahead of our trip to China. It is not every time that the secretary would go to any given country that he would be meeting with the president of that country. Sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. And so that was just a reflection of this trip. But I know the secretary had good, constructive meetings with his Chinese counterparts that he met with yesterday.
Has the U.S. asked to such meeting to happen? Has the United States asked China ask Chinese government to arrange a meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping?
Not to my knowledge. Anything going forward, we'll let you know when we have that planned.
Would you characterize the U.S.-China relationship as a strategic competitor?
Well, look, there's certainly a competitor. It's a complex and broad-based relationship that we have with China, as you all saw in the comments and exchanges between the secretary and his counterparts. We have areas of common interest. North Korea is one of them. Working to combat illegal narcotics is another area where we work well together. We also have areas of disagreement and areas where we have challenges, and we'll keep working together on that. It's obviously an important relationship that we need to work hard to maintain.
Okay.
Yes. Go ahead.
Was the secretary surprised that Ambassador Early resigned? Did you have any comment? Could you share with us what was his reaction?
Well, I think the secretary addressed that from the White House today, in which he talked about what a great partner Ambassador Haley has been. The secretary and Ambassador Haley have worked very well together since the beginning of this administration, but I would say more closely once he became Secretary of State. At the working level, from my level, her team and Ambassador Haley have been wonderful to work with. Sorry to see her depart. This happens, of course, in administrations. The secretary, I think, is sorry to see her depart as well. I'm not going to get into who knew what, when, and all of that. What is ultimately important is that the president knew about her decision well in advance. They had those conversations. I'm not privy to those conversations, so I'd have to refer you to the White House for that. We're sorry to see her go and thank her for all her incredible service that she's done on behalf of the U.S. government and on taxpayers at the United Nations. Okay? Okay. Last question, I'm going to have to go.
So we saw the exchange of rhetorics when Secretary Pompeo was in China. Would you say those tensions now between United States and China would spill over to your cooperation on North Korea at this very critical time?
We don't think so, because China again and again has said to us, publicly and privately, that they are committed to the denuclearization of North Korea. They understand that. They recognize that. They recognize the importance of that matter. We don't think they're backing away. What we do say, though, is that countries, including China and Russia, can always do more. They can do more, but they are also one of the countries that had voted for UN Security Council resolutions, and so we expect those to uphold those. I'll do one last question. Nazira, hi. Were you at the White House earlier today?
Yes.
Did I see you? I thought yeah. I saw your yellow over there.
Yeah.
She gets around.
Okay, thank you. Heather, I have two questions. One question regarding Afghan delegation. Dr. Abdullah was here. What is their, do you think that they have any achievement? Do they meet any high officials, U.S. authority?
I'm afraid I don't have any information as to whether or not Dr. Abdullah was here at the State Department or here in Washington. I can look.
New York. I'm asking about General Assembly.
At the General Assembly.
Do they have any meeting with the Secretary of State or either President Trump?
I don't recall that. It seems like that was a year ago, even though that was only 2 weeks ago. So I'm so sorry. My apologies. I will have to double check to see if he had any meetings with U.S. officials.
2 weeks ago.
Okay. I'll check on that for you.
Yeah. The next question, Ambassador Khalilzad.
Yes.
He is in Afghanistan and he traveled to Pakistan. Do you think that, useful for Afghanistan, Khalilzad mission?
I think it's extremely helpful to have Ambassador Khalilzad on travel. This is part of our team on the field, having our people do what they do best, and that is going out and conducting American diplomacy around the world. He is leading an interagency delegation to Afghanistan, to Pakistan, to the UAE, to Qatar, and also to Saudi Arabia. It's a fairly lengthy trip. His mission there is to coordinate our U.S. efforts to bring the Taliban to the negotiating table. This is still Afghan-led, Afghan-owned. Our policy has not changed in any way, but we're proud and pleased to have him out there advocating on this behalf, and we'll be working in close coordination with the Afghan government. I've got to go, guys. We'll see you again real soon. Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Descending into tribalism and cultural trench warfare, the highly contentious Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination process has ignited passions and anger on both sides of the aisle. Interestingly and ironically, the point where there is wide agreement is the recognition the status quo is deeply flawed and sadly with no way out. Crosstalking America's chaotic politics, I'm joined by my guest Daniel Lazar in New York. He's an author and a freelance journalist who writes frequently about the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the U.S. Constitution. In Philadelphia, we have Kathy Barnett. She is a veteran and political commentator. And in Los Angeles, we have Ron Placone. He is a comedian, frequent guest on The Jimmy Dore Show and The Young Turks, as well as host of his own streaming show, Get Your News On with Ron. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Well, Ron, you know I'm going to go to you first because I always go to the person that got up earliest for this program, and that's you in Los Angeles. And you look great. I think you got a lot of coffee in you. I came across an article here. White women, come get your people. They will defend their privilege to the death. It was by a woman named Alexis Grenell, and she writes, White women benefit from patriarchy by trading in their whiteness to monopolize resources for mutual gain. White women are expected to support the patriarchy by marrying within their racial group. I could go on and on. This is gobbledygook, but it's in the New York Times. This sounds like progressive racism or progressive tribalism. Take your pick. What do you think, Ron?
Well, I'm not familiar with that article. I've never read that article, so I can't really speak much to an article I haven't read.
Well, I gave you a sense of it. I gave you a sense of it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't. Yeah, I don't really know like what that is supposed to get at. That you have to benefit from the patriarchy or this or that, or you have to. Yeah, I mean, I I'd have to read the full article to have a way to speak on it. But yeah, I mean, as far as tribalism goes, I mean, I do think we're in an age of ultra tribalism on all sides of the aisle, on the establishment side and then over on the right as well. And then some on the left, too. So as a result, it seems like we're kind of stuck in neutral as a country.
Okay, Kathy. I don't think the word neutral is appropriate. I think it's deadlock, and it's getting worse and worse. Kathy, you wanted to jump in there. That's the whole point of the program. Go ahead.
Yes, I do, because I did read much of that article yesterday, and every single sentence was inflammatory and racist. Talk about the intolerant of the tolerant, quote unquote, left. But, you know, if I recall correctly, she even went on to say that trying to equate a man who is falsely accused of rape is not the equivalent of a woman who has actually been raped, or a woman who is alleging that she's been raped. What kind of universe is that? What she was trying to insinuate is that it's not the same. Being falsely accused of raping someone is not the same as someone who has been raped or someone who is alleging to have been raped. That's upside down. It is just as detrimental to a young man or any man being accused, falsely accused of rape, as it would be, but only in a leftist, liberal, progressive, sloppy thinking kind of society will they try to put the same and say, listen, if it's okay to be falsely accused, because we're making up for all the time women have had to condescend themselves in this culture. And that's the craziness of the left that
Kathy, you brought up the word craziness here. Let me go to Daniel here. I mean, you've written about this here. I mean, what accounts for, you know, after the process, after the nomination process was complete, then we started a completely different asymmetrical process that is not founded in law and not even in common sense, but just simply rage. This is what we're seeing, is rage. And it's mindless rage, I would say. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, first of all, I agree with Kathy, except for one point. What she's describing is truly crazy, but it's not left-wing craziness. It's an example of how the Democrats and liberals and feminists are rushing to the right. They're engaged in a headlong race of the Republicans to see who can get to the right fastest. Real leftists believe and uphold very strongly with the principles of due process and the assumption of innocence. And I agree totally that a false accusation is very bad. And whether it involves rape or anything else doesn't matter at all. It's very important to withhold judgment until all the facts are in so that nobody is falsely accused. Now, what we're seeing in America, we're seeing an epic breakdown in politics. America has a very old system of government. It's actually the oldest nation on the face of the earth. Its government dates back to 1787, when Catherine the Great was still alive, for example. There was still a Holy Roman Empire. There was still a papal state in Italy, and there was still a monarchy in France. That form of government is with us still today, largely, to a great degree, unchanged. And it is in an epic breakdown. And as it breaks down, the country is going mad. And all kinds of crazy currents are being unleashed. And that includes this kind of weird, strange tribalism and bizarre logic, which says that a false accusation is okay if it involves rape. It's just completely bonkers. But that's where American politics are heading.
Okay, Ron, go ahead. Kathy, real quick, you want to jump in there? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I just want to put a period or a comma here anyway. And that is to say, I think we really have to get our minds around where the Democratic Party was trying to take us back to with this Kavanaugh hearing, for example. Whether some want to say they're trying to take us back to the days of McCarthyism, where a whisper of an allegation could literally destroy your life. Or some may say trying to take us back to the dark days of Jim Crow law. I grew up in the very deep South, and I remember the stories of, for example, Emmett Till, a young black boy who was brutally beaten, dragged behind a truck and hung because a white woman made a false allegation that he was trying to talk to her. Or in Alabama, the 9 Scottsboro boys, black boys, ages 13 to 20, five of them who received the death sentence because 2 white women falsely accused them of raping them. And this is where the Democratic Party, the radical Democratic Party, the radical left was trying to take us back to, is where without due process, without the presumption of innocence, someone's life could be utterly destroyed.
Okay, let me go to Los Angeles, Ron.
The Democratic Party, but Peter.
Okay, Daniel, real quick, and then we'll go to Ron.
Peter,
go ahead.
The Democratic Party is not a radical left party. Sorry.
That's really the point, Ron. Let me go to Ron. Ron got up really early for this here. Okay, Ron, a lot has been said. Go ahead and react, Ron. Go ahead.
Yeah, I kind of echo. Yeah, the Democratic Party is not a radical left party. They're not even a left party, in my opinion. I would describe them as a center right party. And I think that's kind of the when I say we're in neutral, that's kind of what I'm referring to. You know, going forward, when you're looking towards the midterms, people are saying there's going to be some blue wave. I do think that Trump fatigue is going to be enough to pick up a little on the Democratic side. But as far as framing a message and framing policy positions and framing what is an actual opposition, the Democratic establishment has not done that. They largely have not done that. So when you don't really have a real opposition in our politics, which I would say at the establishment level, we really don't have, you just kind of have the nonstop ecosphere of a media that we have.
Yeah, well, Daniel's absolutely right, and Ron and Kathy here. I mean, the Democratic Party isn't a radical party, but it is embracing these radicals, their tactics, and their rhetoric, okay? Because I think they're afraid of it as well, okay? Kathy brought up McCarthyism. I mean, this is what's going on. There's very few people willing to stand up to what is really mob politics by fringe groups, okay? Go ahead, Daniel. Hang on, let me go to Daniel first. Go ahead. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yes, I mean, but it's not when you say it's radical, it's important to emphasize it's radical in the sense of the radical right. The Democrats are essentially adopting right-wing neo-McCarthyite policies.
Yes,
in which they are tossing out the presumption of innocence overboard, and this is very dangerous. They are a center-right party, which is moving further to the right. So we have 2 right-wing parties, and the country is galloping to the right the same way Brazil is.
Okay, but
this is completely outrageous to tar the left with this.
Okay, hang on, Kathy, hang on. The Skype there is a little dodgy there. But Kathy, I think what Daniel is saying is that both parties are adopting the same kind of tactics. I think that is very, very true, okay?
Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Democrats.
We have a president who is simply trying to do his job. And on every turn, all he's meeting is resistance, oppression, opposition. Now we have.
You mean like when they fast tracked 15 of his judges so they could go on vacation sooner? That's the type of resistance you're referring to?
That's ridiculous.
What about when they gave him a bigger budget than he even asked for?
That has nothing to do with the presidency. That's the job of Congress to on whether or not how quickly they're going to move
you
someone
said they're resisting Trump.
Hang on, guys. Don't talk over each other. Ron, you get the last 20 seconds before the break. Go.
The idea that the Democrats are really resisting Trump, I think, is nothing short of absolutely comical. They're assisting him in so many ways.
Well, you are living in L.A., so you may believe that.
Okay, it's cultural politics and it's geography politics. I'm going to jump in here after a short break. We'll continue our discussion on chaotic politics. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Daniel here. Let me another quote for the program here that came out on Twitter here. And one of the writers for the not-so-funny late show with Stephen Colbert, a woman named Ariel Dumas, wrote, "Whatever happens, I'm just glad we ruined Brett Kavanaugh's life." React to that, Daniel. I mean, is that juvenile and destructive, mindless and really unhelpful? Because it's really mean-spirited. I think that's what I see when I see a good part of the left. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't agree this woman is on the left. But I certainly agree that it's mindless, mean-spirited, vindictive, etc. But the point is that it's replacing, it has replaced any kind of substantial discussion as to what really ails this country. American government is in breakdown, not because of Donald Trump or because of Brett Kavanaugh. It's breaking down because this ancient constitutional machinery is breaking down. Americans think they live in a democracy. They really live in a minority dictatorship where this ancient constitution essentially empowers minorities in the Electoral College, the Senate, the House of Representatives to lord it over the great majority of Americans who want a more sane society. Now, this is the really important point. And Ron's point about the resistance is actually absolutely correct. The only resistance we see out there is that the Democrats are mobilizing the CIA and FBI in order to attack Trump from the right by stirring up war fever against Russia. It's utterly nuts. It's destructive, and it's only going to have negative consequences.
Let me go back to Ron in Los Angeles. You know, one of the reasons why I like having you on, Ron, because you're one of the people that are progressive that always talks policy. And that's where I think conversations get very, very interesting. You can disagree, but you can hash it out here. This is what this atmosphere right now. I don't see any talk of policy in a serious way. I tend to think because many on the left don't have any policies, don't have any real strong ideas on how to move forward, because Trump has just blinds their thought processes. Okay, and it's a lot simpler and easier just to say it's Brett Kavanaugh is a bad person. All white men are part of the patriarchy. I mean, That's really stimulates a lot of people because it sounds cool, but it's vacuous. It really means nothing. And it's just a form, what I would call, of hate speech. Go ahead, Ron.
Well, I mean, yeah, you haven't seen much policy talk since 2016. You really haven't. And Democrats really haven't kind of taken an autopsy of the whole situation. I'm no fan of Kavanaugh. I think he was an awful choice. I wish he wouldn't have been confirmed at all. But, you know, you didn't see much policy talk, same as, you know, everything that's been going on in the past with judges. And I think it's because Democrats don't really have. And when I say Democrat, I'm talking about at the establishment level. There are some diamonds in the rough. There are some people that are, you know, proposing some great ideas. But those people are in the minority in the party, and they're always expected to bend the knee to the establishment instead of the establishment coming to them and saying, hey, how can we keep our jobs? Because people aren't happy with us. What can we do to keep our jobs? It's not working that way. It's working the other way around. It's, hey, you have some good progressive ideas. Well, we don't want to do that and bend the knee to us or you're out of here. It's completely backwards. Nancy Pelosi not too long ago said, if the Democrats get a lot of power in the midterms, they would instill PAYGO, meaning that every time you wanted to do a policy, you would have to pay for it with some other cut. That basically kneecaps the idea of any progressive policies like single payer health care, like a jobs program, living wages, anything like that. It kind of kneecaps that entire idea. And that's what 92% of the base wants.
You know, Kathy, one of the things that's so disturbing here is that we see the Democrats and many and others on the left that essentially are playing the race card, the sex card. And anyone that disagrees with them, because as Ron points out, not too many people are talking about policy. If you disagree, you're a racist, you're a xenophobe, and you're a sexist. That is not dialogue. That is not a way to come to terms with the chaos that's all around us. Why do you think the Democrats continue to play that card?
And let me just say, all of that that you mentioned has been brought to us by the Democratic Party primarily. But let me also say, I was listening to Daniel a few moments ago, and I feel as though, and to Ron, I feel as though I've somewhat walked into the Twilight Zone when you start talking about the inefficacy of the Constitution. Let it be clear that America does not exist apart from the Constitution. Even our founder, John Adams, says the Constitution is made for a religious and moral people. It's wholly inadequate for any other kind of people, meaning people who understand the difference between right and wrong. And most of the things that we're seeing that transpire in our country today, where we're not talking about policies, where we're not talking about the thing. Well, I'm sorry, Donald Trump and many in the Republican Party are talking about policies. When we talk about trade with China and the rest of the world, that's policy. When we talk about the NAFTA, undoing NAFTA, that's policy. When we talk about how we're going to interact with Iran, with other despot regimes like North Korea, that's policy. So, and when we talk about securing our borders, that's policy. So the right, represented by President Donald Trump, is talking about policy all the time. But then we have this, you may not want to call it radical, but there is a significant radical element when we have Senator Hirono, Democrat from Hawaii, telling people that it's okay to get up in the faces of your elected official or basically anyone who doesn't agree with you and to resist them, as Maxine Waters says, to push back on them. That's radical. And that is what is destroying.
I don't know if it's radical, but I'm certain that it's not productive, Daniel, at all here. What's really quite fascinating to me as the midterms approach is that it seems to me the Democrats are doing almost everything in their power to push people away from it, because there is this perception that the party is radical or won't stand up to radicals. I mean, all you have to do is watch the airwaves. I mean, you could watch CNN, MSNBC and Fox News, see the same pictures, and people are going to come to very different conclusions. That's one of the interesting times that we live in here. You could see the same things and draw radically different conclusions. Go ahead, Daniel.
Listen, I love to bash the Democrats as much as anybody. I just hate the Democrats. I loathe and despise them. But we can't let the Republicans off scot-free. The Republicans are a minority party that have used their constitutional advantages to grab control of all the major institutions in Washington, and now the Supreme Court. They are using racial politics to solidify their power. Trump was elected by a minority of the people. He still grabbed power via the Electoral College. The Senate, as I said, 54% of the country lives in 10 states, which are overwhelmingly Democratic, but they are outvoted 4-1 by the 80% that lives in the other 40 states, thanks to this ridiculous Senate concept of equal state representation. And the Republicans have gerrymandered the House to the point where they now have an 11% advantage over the Democrats, a built-in 11% advantage. So this minority party has now just captured control of the fourth branch, or the fourth major institution, the Supreme Court. So don't tell me that the Democrats are the ones solely guilty of using this kind of minority politics, because the Republicans are playing the game even better.
Okay. I do not agree with that assessment whatsoever. I mean, it's very eloquent, but it's not true. When we talk about the Supreme Court, one of the importance of having Brett Kavanaugh confirmed to the Supreme Court is that now Democrats primarily who do not pass large sweeping legislations other than with the exception of Obamacare. Prior to Obamacare, it is not within the repertoire of Democrats to pass large sweeping legislation to fundamentally change our nation. Instead, they sidetrack the people. They go straight to activist judges. Now that we have Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, who makes it decidedly conservative, meaning that the Supreme Court will now interpret the Constitution, not rewrite the Constitution. And I do not believe that the Constitution is a living, breathing document to be open and to be Neanderthaled with at every generation's disposal.
Okay, Ron, it seems to me that, you know, both parties like to use the Constitution as a weapon. And not it was intended here. I mean, now we hear the Democrats, if they get control of the House, which is really kind of nonsensical, then they're going to try to pack the court where they couldn't even do that. But I mean, it's just it seems to me there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the system should do. And it's being cherry picked for whatever partisan agenda you want to push. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, I think Daniel and I kind of see eye to eye on some of the stuff that's going on contemporarily. And I'm not used to anybody agreeing with me on this show, Peter. So I'm a little weirded out. I don't know where I fit in now. But but yeah, I think it's become, you know, the whole purpose of the Supreme Court is to, you know, hold up the law and to, you know, give those interpretations when necessary. And it seems that as of recent, and maybe it's always been that way, it's just, you know, we're seeing a much bigger light on it because of what's going on contemporarily. But it seems more as just a way to serve one political agenda or the other. And that's not something I think we'll all actually agree on this panel.
That's my point exactly here. Okay, Daniel, I'm going to give you 20 seconds. How to fix the system. 20 seconds, go.
Right. The law is unfair. That's the whole point. The law is unfair. The 50 Republicans who voted for Kavanaugh represent less than 37% of the U.S. population. How is that fair? How is that democratic? The law is undemocratic. The law has got to change. This absurd 18th century constitution has got to go. Americans are, the huddled masses of America are yearning to breathe free, but this pre-modern constitution won't allow that. This is insane.
Okay, well, then I say change the law legally and democratically and no revolution. No revolution. That's all the time we have, folks. Okay, many thanks to my guests in New York, Philadelphia, and in Los Angeles. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.